Bunch of things. This is going to be the last regular lecture that I would be giving. I sent a mail. Those of you who got the mail probably know that I'm going to accept the third project report until Monday. You're not here. Why are you here? Until Monday. So the basic idea is that these extra days you're going to write better. I found that that's actually a good idea, and I always wanted to try it, and this time I'm trying it. This year, deadline was changed last minute, and he knows that because it was changed in the very last minute, all of us used the extra time to actually improve the writing of the paper. Whereas if they told us beforehand, we would just not, we would basically wait until the last minute again and try to write it. So I'm hoping that your reports and your evaluations will be better if you do it by, if you have the time until Monday. The structure for the next class, actually you should check your mails. I'm going to send more information on this, but essentially, you are going to, each of you are going to, is going to have a chance to talk about what are the things that you thought were useful for you and what are the things that you thought you spent too much time on. This is basically, and then I will try to put some more other things because we actually have a lot more time next class and fewer people. I probably will send you a couple more things to think about that you would have to talk about. But at the minimum, you need to basically don't copy whatever these guys said. These are the last year's guys and what they thought were interesting versus not interesting in terms of the topics, not in terms of the instructor or his dress. All that stuff you get to do separately in the instructor evaluation. This is mostly as a kind of a review, and normally it's very interactive. You guys will talk about what are the things, some of the things that caught your attention. And other people may have comments on it. I may have comments on it. And in general, it turns out to be a much better way of reviewing, believe me, than me showing you the list of topics. If you do want to see the list of topics, and without it, you won't feel as if a course really got done, you can always go to this, and that's the list of topics that we did. That's the interactive review. It'll take 3 seconds. The teacher review. But I'm hoping that we will see what are the things that you remember. Okay, so that's the minimum thing that you would be doing. I hope to send you guys mails about a couple of other things that are worth thinking about for this. Okay, Hemal went to pick up these sign-up sheets, basically for the demo for the overall project. Okay. So either you can do it between now and the end of the week. Okay, so Thursday, Friday. Okay, there you go. Thank you. So I have in front of me here two sheets. I almost can expect the answer, but let me ask you anyway. So you can either do your demos. There are slots here and you sign up for them. You can do the demos from December 1st to December 5th, which is from today till Monday, or from December 5th to 7th, Monday to Wednesday, which would you rather have?
5th to 7th.
Okay, nobody wants to do it right now, I guess. So here I'm sending this. I'll just start in the middle so that there is no bias of earlier people getting better slots. So you can sign up on those cheat sheets, and I would suggest that each of you pass it to a random next person rather than, a random neighbor rather than the lattice neighbor. We'll talk about lattice versus random neighbors today, but just so that everybody would get a reasonable chance at getting the prime spots, which are all, I'm sure, on the very last day, last evening, which I'm sure this guy is writing up already. You should pass it to a random guy. So anyway, thank God I'm not a high school teacher. Apparently, in high school, people are asking these kinds of questions. I actually thought it was a very nice sentence, but this poor guy is in trouble. At least when we talk about Bush, it's all objective stuff in this class. It's all the Google rank. It's not me who's saying it. Anyway, so what I'm planning to do for the rest of the class today is the remaining discussion on social networks. I hope to be done today. If there is any small minor things left, I'll just, you know, finish complete it on Monday. Before I go there, are there questions, either from last class or anything else? Okay. So what we were talking, if you remember, last class, was so the summary of last class discussion was the following. Many networks, real networks, seem to have small world phenomena. Okay, that means, and a formal way of describing a small world phenomena in a social network is if there are n nodes in the network, okay, the largest path in that network could be normally, in the worst case, if there are n nodes in the network, and an edge between each pair of nodes is considered one length, then what would be the worst case length in an n node network? N minus 1, right? Because you put them all in a line, that would be the longest path. A normal network might have somewhere between n minus 1 and much lower value. And one of the interesting things that that people have found was that most real world networks seem to have a diameter. So this is called the diameter. Diameter is the largest path in the connected component of the network. In most people have found that the diameters of most real world networks seem to be logarithmic in the size of the network, rather than equal to the size of the network, or half of the size of the network, etc. Logarithmic is good, right? I mean, you're basically doing exponentially smaller. So that's the surprising thing. I mean, that the world being as large as it is, you can still get to somebody in so few steps. Okay. So starting from that, we notice that in fact, uniform random networks with degree greater than one, with an average degree greater than one, you can pretty much be sure that small world phenomena would exist. So you can actually prove that if the real world networks were actually generated by, uniform random networks, right, then you should not be surprised at all that there is small world phenomena. Because as long as the average number of neighbors of any node is more than one, average number of neighbors of nodes is more than one, then it's not surprising that there is small world phenomena. And then that was good, except we found that, in fact, real networks are not uniform random networks, in the sense they don't have uniform degree distribution, uniform degree. Okay. Instead, some nodes in this network seem to have much higher. Some nodes, when I say random network here, all we said was whether or not you would put a edge between a pair of nodes, that is decided with uniform probability. Now, if you were to do that, then the resulting degree distribution over the nodes would have sort of a Poisson distribution. Okay. However, in most real-world networks, some nodes seem to have much higher degree, and everybody else seems to have much lower degree. Okay. Basically, instead of having a distribution like this, in most real-world networks, this is the distribution you're finding. So, okay, a few nodes have very high degree, and then the rest have much smaller degree. Okay, if you don't believe this, let's see. That picture, we'll get to it today later, but this is an actual. These guys took the opinions, right? E opinions. They took the nodes in the opinion network. So nodes are people who are writing reviews. And the degree would be how many reviews somebody has written. That would be the out degree. And in degree would be how many people would they be trust. In and out degree are in terms of trust. So how many trust judgments a particular user has made about other users. That's the out degree. And how many trust judgments other people have made about this user. That would be in degree. Okay? We'll get to this trust issue a little later. Notice the interesting part. Just if you look, if you plot the degree distribution, so here is the number of nodes and the degree distribution. And you'll notice that it's basically, this is a log-log space. And in fact, one of the interesting things about that power law distribution is, in log-log space, power law distribution would be a straight line. Okay, so in essence, all we are saying here is, very few nodes have very high degrees, and the rest all have very, very low degrees. Okay, so that's the power law. And it turns out that whichever you take, if you take out degree and in degree in terms of hyperlinks pointing to and pointing from a node in the web graph, it too, if you draw this as the log-log plot, it too will have the power law distribution. And so the interesting thing, of course, is the only difference would be what is the slope of this line? What is the slope of the line? And that normally seems to be between 2 and 3. It's a power law between square or cube. Okay. So our power law distributions are straight lines in the log-log space, and with the basically the power being between 2 and 3. And this has been observed on many, many real-world networks. So in fact, this one is showing, this is for the World Wide Web hyperlinks. Okay. And the second one is the co-starring in movies. And the third one is co-authorship of physicists, among physicists. The fourth one is co-authorship among neuroscientists. Okay, these are completely different types of social networks. And yet, in log-log space, all of them seem to have the straight line, which basically means they're all power law distribution. So their degree is actually power law distribution. So the question is, now that we know real-world networks have this property, how could you generate networks with this property if you were to generate them randomly? Notice that the power law distribution is an emergent property. You are looking at globally and over the entire network. So when you are making the social network, when each node is being added, it needs to decide how many, in some sense, you're making decisions as to how many edges would I have. In the uniform probability network, each node essentially says, with probability P, I'll have an edge with each of the nodes. So I need a decision procedure like that. How do I do the local procedure such that if I do it repeatedly, I'll get power law distribution? And let's see. And what I said last time as we were ending the class is power law distributions will come up if you do any of these as the generative model. It's the if, it's not only if. There are other ways of generating power law distribution. Okay. Now these ifs make sense for at least things like the way World Wide Web link structure might have evolved. If you were to posit a generative model. Okay. So one is basically the idea is preferential attachment, where you say rather than every node, I would attach to every node with uniform probability. An attach is a link. Okay. Preferential attachment says, I would like to attach to the nodes which already are popular. Okay, so I'm biased towards having links to nodes which have already higher popularity in terms of higher in degree, let's say, or higher out degree. Okay, an alternative version is copy model, where the node comes into the network and in essence says, I'll take one of the existing nodes in the network, take a fraction of its links and copy them as if they are mine. And in fact, people have argued, at least for a while, that most average Joe making a web page normally copies somebody else's web page and starts editing it. And so if that other guy has a bunch of links already built in saying my favorite pages, you just take them as your favorite pages. Okay, so Yahoo would be your favorite page too because that guy wanted it to be there. Okay, so what's interesting is both of these will give you power law distribution. Okay, so now the question is, now, you know, for reasons that we mentioned briefly last time, these are called, these have also been called scale-free networks. So the idea is the distribution degree, you know, the slope of that thing does not seem to depend on how big is the network sample you have taken. Okay? So the exponent in the power law doesn't seem to depend. It only seems to depend upon whether it's a hyperlink or it is a co-citation database in physics or it's protein-protein interaction networks. But it doesn't seem to depend upon how big is the network of protein interactions that you're taking. Okay? So part of that reason, that's the reason why you're talking about, they're called scale-free networks. And in fact, one of the interesting questions we have, you know, given that we came in this funny way, we started from small world phenomena and said, well, we can explain it if the world is random, but then said, no, the world doesn't have random, uniform random networks. Now that means we still haven't explained small world phenomena. So the question is, for the networks that seem to exist in the world, can we mathematically show that there is small world phenomena there too? Okay, that means if you have a network that's grown using one of these copy model or the preferential attachment model, would it be the case that the diameter of those networks would be approximately logarithmic in the size of the network? Turns out that the answer is yes. I'm not proving it. All I'm saying is I'm summarizing the results. Okay? For each of these models, you actually need to show that you would get a logarithmic diameter for the network. Okay? So it looks as if, so in fact, they even found that for a random graph, random power law graph having the same power law distribution as the web graph, okay, it can be shown that the average path length would be this expression. And that does have a log in it, which is the telltale signature of a small world network. It's logarithmic. The average path length is this. It's logarithmically proportional to the size of the network, which is very nice. Okay, which is why it is. So in fact, you can even get bounds like this. Okay, so that's good. So then, how does it matter that our world is actually small world? How does it matter that the real world networks are not random uniform networks, but rather scale-free or power law random networks? Because at least from the small worldness point of view, it doesn't seem to matter. It does matter in a different way. Where it does matter is, you know, if you just look at the pictures here, you notice that in this kind of network, all nodes are almost created equal. In this kind of network, some nodes are much richer, other nodes are much poorer. So now, think about two things, two types of failures that you can cause to a network. Failure one is just random failure. Okay? So you randomly pick a subset of nodes and remove all their connections. Okay? So the question is, how much of an effect will it have on the network? And the larger that random subset, the more disruption would be caused here. And first of all, any things that you remove, it starts making the network connectivity go down. So in particular, as the network connectivity goes down, the diameter keeps increasing. Okay? And in fact, you can show that as the random set of nodes are removed from uniform random networks, the diameter monotonically increases. On the other hand, here, if you remove random sets of nodes, the diameter doesn't get affected at all. Because if you were to pick random nodes, truly random nodes, what's the chance that you'll pick Yahoo and Google as your random nodes? Right? So if random number of people keep dying, you know, rich people are not likely to be, you know, very, not very likely to be one of those. Okay. So from the point of view of random failures, these networks are not as good as these. Scale-free networks actually are more robust with respect to random failure. Now, turn thing around. Suppose I'm attacking. If I'm attacking a network, I'm not going to be just randomly taking out some nodes. I'm going to look for who are the most important nodes and remove them. Right? And you know that in attack, the important principle is the weakest link. Right? So the idea here basically is because there is a here most of the nodes are pretty much uniform. So whichever you remove, it's not going to change the change. So attacker doesn't have any extra leverage than a random failure model. Here, on the other hand, attacker has a humongous leverage. They can list the nodes in the order of reducing degree and start removing them in that order. And you can have humongous failure. Okay? So in fact, the interesting thing is scale-free networks are more prone to attacks than uniform random networks. Okay? This should not be surprising because if that weren't to be the case, you wouldn't have heard about terms like denial of service attacks. Right? I mean, the whole point of denial of service attacks is you know that certain nodes are more important in the web than others. And you kill them and you get the web to its knees. Now, this is something that you know, but all I'm saying is you can explain it from the point of view of power law network. Okay? Now, what you think, you know, when you think of attack, it looks like attack is a bad thing if it is the web under consideration. But if you are trying to stop an epidemic spread, attack is a good thing. You want to stop the epidemic. You are the attacker on the epidemic. Okay? And once again, the idea then is since the spread of epidemics in social networks, those social networks are also they also follow power law distribution. So rather than just randomly taking people and quarantining them, you are much better off looking for what are called super spreaders. In fact, this is not a name I made. This is a known terminology in the areas where they talk about stopping spreads of epidemics. So you look for super spreaders and you cut some of those out. You know, heck with their civil rights is basically the point. And then put them behind the bars until the epidemic goes out. You have a much better chance. You actually have the leverage. Okay? And in fact, I think in one of the mails I sent, I actually talk about some studies that have shown, for example, how various diseases, sexually transmitted diseases or anything which you have, okay, how they spread and how they can show that certain very small subset of individuals wind up being most responsible for the contagion. Okay? And this is not surprising given typhoid Mary sort of points that we looked at last time. Okay. Now, this comes to the next point. So we talked about till now that real world networks have small world phenomena. Uniform random networks will give you small world phenomena. Power law networks are more closer to real world, but thankfully they too give you small world phenomena. We kept talking about small world phenomena. In small world, of course, the important thing is the diameter is logarithmic in the size of the network. So the question is, how easy is it to find your way around in a small world? Okay? Now, there are two ways of looking at it. So how does a node in a social network find a path from itself to another node? Okay? Even if you think of things like 6 degrees of separation, which is, the diameter is only 6. Basically, 6 degrees of separation says the diameter is 6. Right? Even if you think that is the case, then if I am supposed to find the path myself between me and some other random person, and I don't have any global knowledge other than who are my own friends, okay, then if my friends are 20, you know, if on the average each person has 20 friends, then you're talking about 20 power 6 size space that you need to actually execute. Okay, so the way it would go is, you know, I will tell my friends, hey, look, you know, I'm like looking for, you know, somebody. And then they will tell their friends and so on. Now, telling all my friends for every little thing will ensure that my friends will be reduced to empty set. Right? That's a great way of losing friends. Okay, and in fact, in the Milgram experiment, he didn't say that you get to give this letter to everybody. There is a single letter, and these were the days before Xerox machines and, you know, PDF files. So you have to take this letter and give it to one of your friends who you think is likely to be able to get it to the Boston stockbroker in the least number of steps. Okay, so the question is, how does that, just because you are in a small world does not necessarily mean that you will find a path which is actually anywhere close to the logarithmic size of the network. Okay, so until I showed you that slide last day before yesterday, I did not realize that I was only two links away from President of India and another two links away from the Prime Minister of India. So if you were to ask me to get a, you know, call this guy, you know, and get a favor, I would have gone on a much, much longer route. Okay? So what happens in local search is you do not know anything other than your own neighbor. And once you give this letter to the neighbor, one of the neighbors, then they will have to do the same sort of decision that you are doing and commit. Okay, because of this, in fact, many letters did not ever reach. In the Milgram experiment, most of the letters did not reach anywhere. People lost interest after a while. You know, some neighbor decided, I have no clue where this is supposed to go. And he stopped. So in fact, only 20% of the letters reach the stockbroker. And nowadays, they're trying to do the Milgram experiment on the web, you know, those were US mail, you know, snail mail, all that stuff. Let's do it on email, which is lightning speed. You know what is the percentage that they're getting? 1%. Because we are even more sick of mail than before. Thanks to all the Nigerians and all the other people asking, you know, giving us such great opportunities for, you know, commercial enterprises. We, you know, even if some random friend says, you know, why don't you send this to a stockbroker? That looks like a great spam mail to me. And I would just not follow up on it. Okay. So it's important to understand. So in fact, the Erdős number, right? I talked about my Erdős number being 4. I did not know that my Erdős number was 4 until the class that I came. And I have been interested in finding out what my Erdős number is. And how would I actually find out what my Erdős number is if I were to use my local knowledge? I have to look at who are all my collaborators and look at who their collaborators might be, look at who their collaborators might be, and then try to figure this out. Okay, and it's not easy. Now, I decided I want to find this out, and I did it in like 3 seconds when I was preparing the lecture day before yesterday. Why? Because MathSciNet has the entire global database of papers and co-authors. If you have the entire world in front of you, finding the path is 310, CSE 310, which is, you know, finding paths on the graphs, finding shortest paths on the graph. Okay? If I give you an n-size graph and you want to find all the paths between all nodes and all other nodes, that's Alpair shortest path algorithm. You can do it very fast if you have the entire network, which is exactly the way all these guys like friend of a friend networks, these R codes and the friendsters, etc., want to do it. Okay? And the way they do it is they basically keep asking each of you, why don't you put your part of the network? And let's all put brick by brick, and then we control the building. You know, we control the database. You know, and then we can tell you who are, you know, what are the paths and so on. This is a very important point. Whether or not you have the entire database in front of you. Okay, if you have entire database in front of you, entire graph in front of you, it's just a graph search problem. If not, then it becomes a distributed search problem where each individual node only knows its neighbors and it is trying to, in essence, do real-time search. Okay, one of the differences, you know, between this and this view is here you have the graph, so you can do simulations on the graph and find out what's the best path. And then once you find the best path, you just execute it. So you call that friend and ask them to give it to the other friend and so on. You tell them what to do. Right? Whereas here, the only search you can do is real-time search. You pick what you think is your most likely neighbor, and then give them the message, and then say, you know, you give it to who you think is your most likely neighbor, and remember this message needs to go to this Boston stockbroker or whoever it is. And each of them have to make decisions, local decisions, as to which of their neighbors are likely to be closer to the goal. So they need heuristics, except the heuristic is now life and death, because you're using that heuristic to commit to a node. Okay? Of course, there is the other dumb idea, which is broadcast. So, and I said, you do broadcasting, you would not have any friends. Right? I mean, if for every little thing you call all your friends, then you won't have friends. And in the case of network scenario, in fact, this part of an idea could also be in terms of, you know, in the routers on the internet have to find paths between different nodes. Okay? There are ways of doing this such that there's a centralized database and every network, every node knows where exactly it is, and so on the map it finds the path and it just sends it. Okay? The other one would be each of them only know some local knowledge and they need to send the packet where they need to send it. Okay? And broadcast methods don't work too well because it basically floods the network. Okay. So this brings us, so this easy. Okay, all the friend of friend networks use it this way, except they control the map. None of you have the map, they have the map, and you just build pieces of that map for them. Now, if you are trying to find out your own Erdős number without access to MapSciNet, then you would be doing more like this kind of a directed search. So the question that a very smart guy that you already know, John Kleinberg, asked himself was, is it really the case that decentralized search on a small world network would always be efficient? Okay, just because there is a small path doesn't mean you would be smart enough to find it. Okay, so the question is, what are the conditions, in particular, we are basically interested in finding if agents are working with local knowledge, and remember that this is not applicable to friend of friend networks, okay, because they have global knowledge. If you are working at the local knowledge, then is it the case that in all small world networks, you can find paths between any pair of nodes? I mean, pairs of nodes can find paths between themselves very fast. That is, they'll find that path in time proportional to the diameter of the network, which we know, because it's a small world network, which we know is logarithmic in the size of the network. Or is it that they will actually find a much longer path, or give up, even? Okay, and so what we are going to look at is searchability in small world networks, where searchability is measured in terms of expected time to go from a random source to a random destination, where each, if you start with the source then has to commit by saying I'll send the message to this node, and then that node has to commit. All this message has is the destination node's name, and so if it ever reaches destination node, then it will say, yay, we got it, and so destination node won't send it any further. Everybody else has to say, hey, we are not this guy. The question is, who do I give it to in my neighbor? Such that I will still go to the destination. Okay? So that's the question. So we do know that in small world networks, the diameter is exponentially smaller than the size of the network. So as long as the expected time is sort of proportional to the diameter, you are actually efficient. When you wind up being like exponential in the diameter, then you are back to the size of the network, which is bad. So what the question that Kleinberg was asking himself is it always the case that in small world networks, you would find path efficiently? That means in logarithmic time in the size of the network. And you can't answer this question arbitrarily. What you had to do is, first of all, because all we looked at till now is what small worldness means. All it means is the diameter is logarithmic in the size of the network. And we know at least two ways of generating them. One using random uniform and one using power law. But neither of these actually tell us anything about a very crucial question that each node has to answer in the distributed search, which is given a message with destination node's name on it, which of my neighbors is the best one I should give it to? To do this, I basically have to have some idea about which of my neighbors is likely to be closest to the final node that I want to get to. Now, just because you are close doesn't mean that there is actually a path. But that's what heuristics are always telling you. You know, straight line distance says these two points are close because straight line distance between them is very small. It's possible that there is like a, you know, whatever, the crevasse between these two points. And so you really cannot, it's like straight line distance between north rim and south rim. I had actually a friend who decided to see south rim and stay overnight in north rim. And so he had reservations in the north rim lodge and he thought it's only 10 miles and I'm sure there would be a nice bridge and he can cross. And you know what happens, right? There's 245 miles from south rim to north rim. And he wanted to obviously see sunset, for crying out loud. I mean, if you go to Grand Canyon, you should see sunset, and then drive to north rim to try and sleep. And he gave up, okay, because heuristic didn't work. But that doesn't mean that the heuristic is a bad heuristic. In fact, straight line distance is most of the time a very good heuristic. So the question then is, you need to have some notion of baseline distances, okay, right? So the idea is Grand Canyon, North Rim, and South Rim have coordinates. Just using the coordinates, you can compute their straight line distance. Whether or not you can go from North Rim to South Rim by that distance is a very different issue. The geodesic distance is basically the road distance, which is much, much worse than the straight line distance. And you won't find the geodesic distance unless you know everybody's neighbor. And my friend, or you have like a map, which we actually have, and my friend did. Okay, and he didn't look at it at any rate. Okay? So even if you did not have a map of United States, if you just knew latitude and longitude of the two places, you can tell whether they're close or far apart, just from the crow flies kind of a measure. So what Kleinberg had to do is to look at embedding networks in some space. Okay, so in essence, he considered a lattice, a d-dimensional lattice. Okay, and then basically in such a lattice, the neighborhood is well defined. So for each node, you know what its lattice neighbors are. Okay, then you can generate networks in such an you can generate networks in such a, so here is lattice and here are nodes. And the question, of course, is in generating the network, you need to decide which of these nodes will wind up having connections to each other nodes. So just because there's a lattice doesn't actually mean that you can go from here to here. This could be south rim, this could be north rim. In most cases, you would have connections to your neighbor. Okay? In some cases, you would also have, with low probability, you will have wind up having connections to your non-neighbor. So this was the model that he was using. It turns out that this is a different model from the two ones we looked at. You know, one was power law distribution-based network generation. Another is uniform distribution-based network generation. This is neighborhood-based network generation. The good news is that even for the neighborhood-based network generation such as this, small world phenomena exist. Now what Kleinberg, so he knew that whatever network he generates, it will have small world property. That means the diameter is actually logarithmic. The only question is, will distributed search on this network actually reach, I mean, will it have good efficiency in terms of reaching destinations in reasonable time? Okay. So, in particular, what they wind up doing So, the parameter alpha controls the probability that, and actually I should have put that information, but I'll say it now, and when I go home, I'll add that information. So, if I'm here, right, in trying to decide whether I have edge between me, I mean, when I'm generating the network, whether or not there's a network between, edge between this node and this node, okay, what you do is the probability of that is distance power minus r, minus alpha. That's the probability, distance power minus alpha. So the smaller the distance between you and the other node, the higher the probability that you would have a link with them. The larger the distance, the lower the probability. The parameter alpha essentially decides how fast does the probability fall off. If alpha is 2, that's like the, you know, basically it starts falling off like gravitation, inverse square. If it is 1, it'll, you know, basically just directly linearly proportional to the distance. Okay? And if it's much more than 2, then you know that you basically only know your neighbor. So what he did was he started playing around. So now the first question is, where is the distance d coming? That is the lattice distance. In a network, there is no distance between nodes. Until you start putting edges, there is no distance. The edge-based distance is always called the geodesic distance. Okay? And when you have a network already embedded in a lattice, then if you don't know the geodesic, you may not know the geodesic distance, but you'll always know the lattice distance. That's just a coordinate between the two coordinates. In particular, on the lattice, he uses Manhattan distance. If you know the coordinates of lattice structure, he just uses the Manhattan distance to figure out the distance between two points. That's the D. And see, he knows how to put, you know, the probability that you would have the edge to it. So he played with this for d-dimensional lattice. Now he obviously played with d equal to 2, that is two-dimensional lattice. And one of the interesting things that he found was when alpha is small, okay, actually I'm using the letter d in multiple ways. This should probably be called r, which is the lattice distance. D is the number of dimensions of the lattice. R is the distance between the two points that for which you are deciding whether or not there should be an edge. And alpha is how fast the probability of alpha. Okay, so there are three different things. Now, what he found essentially was, in fact, even before he did anything, you know what is to be expected. Okay, in particular, if alpha equal to 0. Now, let's look at this. If alpha is very high, okay, then what happens? If alpha is very high, then the probability that you would have a link to anybody far away is very low, which means you will wind up having a world where, in essence, things will start becoming clustered into small subcommunities. Okay, and in fact, in that case, the world won't even be small world. Okay, and if alpha is low, then what happens is too many people are your neighbors. You have people very close to you who are your neighbors, people who are very far away from you who are also your neighbors. So if you are trying to decide when given a message which neighbor to call, you're confused because everybody is your neighbor. Okay, what happens actually, essentially, is you know that it's kind of bad here. The question is it sort of like that? And as interestingly enough, in fact, it has a phase transition sort of a behavior. It dies down at alpha equal to 2, almost as if Newton is having the last laugh. But this is only true for two-dimensional space. for two-dimensional lattice, the expected time you would spend finding path between any random pair of nodes is lowest when alpha in the generative model is 2. And it's bad in both sides, on both other sides. And in fact, Kleinberg also shows that alpha for a d-dimensional lattice, the lowest value for alpha would be d. This is two-dimensional, so alpha is 2. So the important point that we are learning here is not all small world networks are created equal. In fact, all these guys are small world networks. This side is all small world networks, and yet you can get confused because too many people are your neighbors. Okay, so in essence, when you have alpha equal to 2, you have this desirable, so-called desirable property that most of your physical neighbors are also your friends. And every once in a while, you have far away people who are your friends. So friends, let's say, is age. Neighbor is just physical neighbor. One of the interesting things that I found when I first came to US is just because of the lack of cars and, you know, pain of going around on the buses, in India, your neighbors are your friends. Okay? And I found that when I first came to US, that I would not know my neighbor. And in fact, the first time we had a problem in our apartment and I needed to knock on their door, you know, they essentially welcomed us with a dog and a gun. Okay? And so, you know, there are two people here physically close to each other, and you drive 20 miles that side to find your friend, and this guy drives 40 miles this side to find their friend. Okay? So in small world network, what we are saying is most of your friends are actually your neighbors. Okay, but you do have friends far away. Have you guys seen the Bostonian view of the world, or the New Yorker view of the world, or the San Francisco guys' view of the world? These are the cups that you can buy. Okay, it turns out I'll send you. If you have never seen it, I'll send you the original poster, which somebody wrote as a New Yorker poster, a New Yorker magazine poster, saying the Manhattan 7th Avenue guys' view of the world. And it turns out the map of the world is sort of foreshortened, such that 7th Avenue is like this much, okay? And then from there to up to that is the rest of the New York, and from there up to that much is the rest of the United States, and from there up to even smaller is the rest of the world, okay? And in a sense, that's what people do. That's how people have, you know, many of their network connections, you know. In fact, the fact that that cup sells like hotcakes. After this guy came up with the 7th Avenue view of the world, they made a Bostonian view of the world, and we can make a Tempe view of the world, which, you know, makes Gilbert like so far away. You know, we don't even know it exists. You know, I have nothing against Gilbert. I mean, my good friends like Chittabara live there, but you know, I only go there once in a while. So the point essentially is, you not only want small worldness, you also want a bias towards links to your neighbors. Okay, and then you're getting good behavior in terms of searchability. Now, in fact, this minimum actually occurs, you know, whenever I say something is a polynomial algorithm. I mean, a problem is polynomial. What do I mean by that? That means I can exhibit an algorithm that can solve that problem in polynomial time. Doesn't mean that any algorithm will solve the problem in polynomial time. You know, sorting is polynomial for me. Okay, but you can find an exponential algorithm for sorting very easily. So the question is, when this guy said he found polynomial, what did he do? All he essentially did was he picked, you know, in the case of local search, algorithms can't be too darn smart. They have to just use something about the known distance measurement. What they would do is each node takes the message, looks at who is the destination, you know, the coordinates of the destination, takes the coordinates of all its neighbors, finds the distances, take basically the lattice distances, whichever has the lowest distance, gives it there. So once in a while, it will give this thing to South Rim and asking it to send it to North Rim. So in those cases, it will die. But in most cases, it will succeed. Okay? And in fact, in a social scientist also have found that people in general are good at finding their way around, even without major databases hanging out of their heads, you know, even without transistor database on their head, as long as their dimensionality of the lattice they are navigating is about 2 or 3. Now, whenever you talk about dimensions, what do you think are these dimensions? It's X and Y, but you know, what is X, what's Y? Normally, sociologists find that people tend to have the space in terms of geographical distance, professional distance. That's like two dimensions. Okay? I may be close to somebody in geographic distance and far away in professional distance. It turns out my distance to my wife is 6, which is only 1 unit less than my distance to Turing, okay, in terms of co-citation, professional distance. In fact, there's only 1 course she dropped in her entire life, that's artificial intelligence. There's only 1 course I withdrew from in my entire life, that's VLSI design. Okay? So that's how we keep our marriage. Okay. But on the other hand, on a different dimension, in terms of neighborhood dimension, you know, we are much closer. Okay? So mostly people tend to search, I mean, there are studies showing that people tend to organize their lattice in terms of profession and geography. And these guys already said you can do quite well in up to 3 dimensions. Again, when social scientists say this, what they'll do is they'll do this Milgram kind of experiment. You know. Okay. Let me summarize what we said, and because this is sort of a circumlocutory argument of what we have seen till now. Okay. So first we found that a network is considered to exhibit small world phenomenon if its diameter is approximately logarithm of its size. Then we found that most uniform random networks do actually exhibit, I mean, are expected to exhibit small world phenomena. So you shouldn't be surprised at it. Then we said most real networks are not uniform random. And most of them actually tend to have power law behavior. Not all, but most. Okay? However, most power law random networks also exhibit small world phenomena. Okay? Of course, they have another problem, which is they are more brittle against attacks. But you can't change this. You know, you can't tell people to start having, you know, different kind of internet than the one that they have. Because internet, you know, grew the way it grew. And your French circle grows the way it grows. And then the fact that a network exhibits small world phenomena does not mean that an agent with a strictly local knowledge will actually efficiently navigate it. As I said, I didn't know what my ADOSH number was until I had access to MathSciNet's database. In fact, there's a nice anecdote. One of the guys who, you know, in the previous slide we talked about this guy Watts and Dodd. I forget but which one, but one of them was asked. These guys are social scientists who spend their life on this sort of stuff. And somebody asked them, "What's your ADOSH number?" And so this guy apparently spent 2 days figuring out what it is. You know, serves him right. He didn't know MathSciNet exists, but you know, he actually did small world navigation. And it wasn't all that small at all for him. Okay. If you have, however, this doesn't necessarily mean too much for your friend-of-friend network services because they keep a global database. In which case, it's easy. Okay. Now, so that's all I think very interesting. It's about the structure of the social networks. But let's talk about what are the applications of social networks to web. Okay. Before I even start saying that, we already talked about a ton of applications of social networks to web. Right? In a sense, I mean, I want you to think of this lecture as the continuation of PageRank's Authorities Hubs lecture, not something completely new. Because what is PageRank? It's an importance of a page. It's a social importance of a page. What's authorities and hubs? Hub is a out degree importance of a page, and authority is an in degree importance of a page. And they actually came from social networks. So you should not be surprised at all. I mean, what we did was we also learned something else about social networks beyond what we already used. Okay? So this whole thing we did, and this can take several lectures, and we actually did this already. Okay? That's a humongous application of social network analysis to web. Okay. The second, of course, which I kind of mentioned in passing, we didn't spend too much time, is this notion of finding communities in web. because the whole hyperlink can be thought of as a social link between nodes, because people put those links. And to the extent people put those links, they are social links. Okay, and so you can find communities by looking for near cliques in the web graph. And I mentioned in passing last time that there's been a lot of work on that. People actually discovered interesting communities just by link structure. They didn't know what these guys were doing. All they knew was they had more dense connections among themselves than other people. And so they then picked them and actually analyzed their page content, only to find that these are all the guys who are interested in oil spill off of Japanese islands, a particular Japanese island. These are all the guys who are interested in some other aspect. We didn't even know that such a cluster existed until we actually found, you know, there was like a thicket of wires passing between them in terms of these hyperlinks, and you worried, hey, this is a kind of a community. Now, if you are a DoD guy, what do you think? When DoD, Defense Department, what do you think? Hey, this is the way to find terrorist cells, terrorist networks. Okay? I mean, maybe they won't put HREF, but there are, you know, other types of finding cliques. Okay. Again, based on social networks. Now, the one thing that we did not talk about as much, and in fact, that's what I want to talk for the rest of today's and maybe, you know, a couple of minutes of next class, is analyzing and propagating trust, which is another thing that you can talk about in the context of social networks. Okay? So when you talk about trust, essentially you think that friends you kind of trust. Let's assume that your friends you trust. And normally, as I said, if you want to get some work done in your home, you don't necessarily go to Yellow Pages. You probably call one of your friends and say, you know, who did you use for this particular thing? And they'll say, you know, this person. And so since you trust your friend's judgment, then you go with them. And if you had a very bad experience, you reduce your link to your friend a little less, a little more. So the next time around, you won't ask them for that particular advice. Okay? That's what we do. So, in essence, and also, basically, we propagate trust over friendships. We do this in real life, okay? And so, the questions that we are interested in is, what does it mean to talk about trust in the context of social networks, and how to use it, and how to use it, of course, everywhere. You can use it in terms of product recommendations, okay? I mean, a product being recommended by your friend is obviously more interesting than a product being recommended by random people, which is exactly why all these people, Google, basically gave each of them 100 mail accounts to give away, rather than sending random mails to people. Okay, of course, Google Mail, probably everybody would have taken it anyway because it's 1 gigabyte. But if you're trying to sell stuff, right, what do they do? Referrals will have points. So you then, what's the classic case of this is, what's this, Amway or something? Yeah, Amway is the classic case, right? So, you know, that's why Amway guys probably don't have any more friends. They decimated all of them. But when they had friends, they were trying to sell stuff. I mean, Amway was trying to have them sell stuff to their friends. And, you know, there is a little incentive worked into the system. Okay? So it should not be surprising. So what we would want to do is look at some technical issues in actually, you know, handling trust and propagating trust in some of the applications. Now, one way of thinking of the main idea in using trust in social networks in the context of web is web is full of spam. And, you know, I was desperately looking for my spam video that I could show you. How many of you have seen the spam video of Monty Python sketch? Okay, you pass, you guys fail. I'll show you next week. Next Monday, we'll definitely see the Monty Python spam video. Because if you don't see that, you don't know what the whole point of spam comes from, that sketch of Monty Python. Okay? You need Monty Python, you need Seinfeld, you need Simpsons. Otherwise, you won't understand anything. So we have spam everywhere. You have spam in email, we have spam in web pages, we have spam in product selling. Random people are selling you products and you don't have any reason to trust them. Okay? So this is and you try to cut down the spam, but hey, there is economic incentive for spammers to spam you. And it's an open arms race. You find some way of cutting down the spam, they'll find another way of getting back at you. So much so that you know, anytime there's an arms race, there's beautiful research to be done. Okay, so the first international workshop on AIRweb, which is adversarial information retrieval. It's not like people are trying to help you; they're trying to hurt you, and you still have to live and find the pages you want to see. That's what web is right now. So the first international workshop on that was held this year. And even before that, from 2004 onwards, there's an annual conference on email and anti-spam. So we will never run out of problems in this world. You know, whenever we are running out of problems, we'll create a new technology which will bring new problems, we'll have new conferences. So choose research. You know, that will never go out of business. Okay. So the question is, how do you handle spam? How do we handle it? Well, we handle it using trust in real life. Okay. A powerful way we avoid spam in our physical world is by preferring interactions with only trusted parties. That's what we do. Okay. And then trust is propagated over your social network in terms of friends, and you tend to trust your friends, and the friends' friends, you trust them a little less. And in fact, when knocking on the doors of strangers, the first thing you do is to identify yourself as, you know, that guy, your friend, you know, I know him from high school. And this is a way you would actually hope to get in, as against being shorted. Okay? We always identify ourselves in terms of the social network so that, you know, that's one way we show our credentials. And I actually think the whole point of knock-knock jokes, you know, I mean, imagine knock-knock jokes won't be anywhere as funny if they went knock-knock, who is there, they give the name and you open the door. You know, they're not funny. Okay? And the whole point is we always ask, after they say something, what do you mean? And, you know, what does that name mean? And, you know, we don't open doors unless we have established that the person knocking on the door is trustworthy. So we can do it in the cyber world too. We only accept product recommendations from trusted parties. Okay? Or we only accept emails from individuals we trust above a certain threshold. That's how we handle junk mail, junk physical mail. Now, some of these things don't scale as well for email, right? But, you know, it's a reasonable idea. And a last idea is you can, in fact, spam also exists in the pages, page rank computations. You know, the entire page rank computation is already, you know, most of it, in the commercial part of it, has been killed because of, you know, nobody is really interested in being the top for Subbarao Kamham Party, other than probably Subbarao Kamham Party, okay? But a lot of people are interested in being the top for surf powder, detergent, something which, you know, people are likely to buy money for. And, you know, pay money for. And so in those cases, they will play with whatever it takes to undo the page rank. So the question would be, you know, when I say page rank, I don't really care about Google's page rank. All I care about is using social networks, we computed the page rank. Can we also use social networks to rescue page rank from oblivion? Okay, well, there are answers. It turns out that, in fact, one idea is to use trust and throw it into the page rank. Okay? I'll get to that in a minute. Let's look at this general idea of trust propagation. Basically, again, these are just general ideas that you agree with. Okay? We know that trust is sort of transitive, but it attenuates as it passes. So if you have a friend, and if you have a good friend who then has a good friend, you start off like this third person, okay? But not necessarily exactly equal to the way you like your friend. So it attenuates, but it is transitive. When things are transitive, they're easier to propagate over networks, okay? In fact, one simple way of propagating trust with attenuation is, let's assume that all the things which have high trust, you put them as one. And when you propagate it, it becomes, for each step you take, you multiply your trust by beta, where beta is a number less than 1, 0 less than, beta less than 1. And so you take 2 steps, it becomes beta squared, 3 steps, it becomes beta cubed, and then so as you go forward, trust gets attenuated. Exactly the desirable behavior. I mean, there are other ways of attenuating trust, but this is one way. Okay, so this slide basically only says qualitative things that you all agree with. Specific ways of modeling trust, you know, nobody really knows. People try different variations, okay? So trust actually may not be symmetric. That's an interesting point, but it doesn't matter. All that matters in propagation is transitivity, not symmetry, okay? Trust is normally additive, normally. So if, in fact, this third guy is both a friend of this guy who is a very good friend of yours and this guy who's also a good friend of yours, then you like this guy more than if you were just a friend of this guy. So trust is additive. So it attenuates, but then at the same note, trust coming from multiple paths sort of adds up. Okay, now this is in fact the way we do in social networks, but the moment you know that trust is additive and you are on the web world, if you are in the cyber world, one thing you do is you give yourself large number of credentials, large number of testimonials saying X likes me, Y likes me, Z likes me, and X, Y, and Z are the same guy with three different web pages. Again, if there is money to be made, we will make it. Okay? So there is a problem there, but in general, if the spoofing isn't there, trust is additive. And then another interesting thing is distrust. You know, there is trust, there is distrust. Distrust is kind of crazy thing. It's not clear how to propagate it rightly. It's not transitive. You know, although sometimes you find nations indulging in this enemy of my enemy is my friend sort of philosophy, it's not really transitive. You could be distrusting your friend for one reason, and that guy is distrusting another guy for good reasons, and so you should also distrust this guy. So sometimes it should be transitive, sometimes it should not be. So it's sort of, there is no universal path, you know, of how to propagate distrust. So in fact, throwing distrust into the mix makes trust propagation harder. Okay? So the question is if you can get away without it. This is a case study of opinions. And there's a paper by Guha et al. In fact, I showed you this earlier, but Guha et al. Had a paper in WWW 2004 where basically what they did was they took the entire opinion trust matrix. What opinions has is n users, and so you have an n by n sparse matrix, okay, where the ijth entry is the trust ith user has in jth user's reviews. Okay, so that's your trust matrix, and so that's your trust graph. And it's a sparse one. In fact, most people don't trust most people. Okay, most people have no trust judgment for most people. It's not that they don't trust, they don't have any trust judgment. Okay, given that sparse matrix, then essentially what opinions is trying to do, you know, in this kind of scenarios is try to show you the reviews that you are most likely to be trusting. And if I have this entire trust web database in front of me, if I have any computer science background at all, I should use it. Otherwise, what's the point? Right? Now, notice that there's this differentiation between trust and reputation. Reputation is sort of a global trust. Okay? Now, it's possible that Bush has a high reputation, but a low trust with respect to a particular user. So the majority of people think very highly of this particular person. But there is a minority of people who can't stand this person. They don't trust them. So if you want to make it user-specific, you're talking about user-specific trust propagation. Most of the current sites just go with reputation, which is like an aggregated trust metric over all users. Just like PageRank is an aggregated importance metric over all users. But here on, as you go forward, you want it to be more user-specific. What are we going to do with all these extra idle life, you know, CPU cycles? You know, computers are still being made faster, so we need to find some useful things to do. Okay, so opinions actually originally started with just a trust matrix. And they found very quickly that, and basically to make people write reviews, they had a royalty system. So that if more people look at your reviews, you get more money. Money. So you wake up. You realize that, you know, you can give people, you know, make up systems whereby lots and lots of people with spurious identities start giving you humongous testimonials to you, okay, and so increase your trust value. So then they actually started seeing that they need to measure distrust too, okay, to kind of combat some of this. Okay, there are other ways they combated it too. So now the question, of course, is how do they combine trust and distrust? Opinions is a company, so it's a black box. You have no clue. So Guha and all basically wrote a paper where they got opinions database and they worked on different ways of propagating trust, different ways of attenuating trust, different ways of combining distrust with trust, okay, and they found a tidy 81 different ways of doing this. in their experimental scenarios. And they thankfully didn't draw 81 different graphs. It's only a 12-page paper. But they drew a whole number of graphs. You are interested, you should look at this. This paper actually ends, the theory of this paper ends in the second page. And from then on, it's all graphs away. Okay? Because the question is, should you have beta value when beta is the way you attenuate, should it be 0.5, 0.3, or 0.2? You have three papers there itself. No, one for 0.3, one for 0.5, one for 0.3, whatever. Okay? What they were trying to do is, what's the right level to attenuate? What's the right level to combine, the right way to combine distrust with trust? Given especially that distrust actually is not transitive. It's a very easy to understand paper. Go read it. And then they come up with, you know, a very nice answer of, it depends, you know, as to which of these 81 things. Okay? Which is why, essentially, other than the qualitative slide I showed you as to which is the right thing to do, I can't tell you much more. Okay? But you can put them together in reasonable ways, just as they did. Okay? And the way they actually check which method is doing better versus worse, is essentially by, you know, they remove some of the, they start with the original trust matrix, remove some of the entries, and they know what they removed. And they try to guess those entries using trust propagation and see whether they are close to what they have removed, how close they are. This is the usual way you do experiments. Because they have the entire matrix. This way they can avoid doing costly user studies. Okay, and then once an approach works, then you can actually put into real practice where if your approach is wrong, only the users will get unhappy, nobody else. You know, you have gotten your paper. Okay, so that's an interesting issue in trust propagation. Once you know how to propagate trust, you can use it for, as I said, product reviews. You know, whose reviews are you going to believe in? You can also use it, obviously, for mails. Like, you can say, anybody who's sending me a mail whose trust, according to my trust propagation, is lower than some value, I won't accept it. Okay? And there are papers on this, as to how to do this. But right now, most of the good spam mailer software seems to be just working on the techniques that we discussed earlier at the spam mailer. Now, here is the thing that came up, that's, you know, I'll end this class with this. This is basically the combining trust propagation with page rank computation. The nice reason I want to end with this is because it's an entire VLDB paper, but I can summarize it to you in one slide because you know already the main idea. We actually thought about it before. Okay, so the idea basically they have is there are too many spam pages, right? And they point to each other and keep increasing their own ranks as far as page rank is concerned. And you want to kill them somehow. That's basically the whole link farms, the idea of, you know, all the different spamming techniques. We read these spamming techniques in one of the papers that you read, the two papers that you read and discussed in the class. One was the anatomy of Google, the other is the Hinzinger, Motwani, Echo, and all paper, and what are the other things that Google should be doing, and that was to deal with this stuff. Okay? So one of the smart ideas is to say that, well, the spammers rarely have too many links from good people. So they're kind of ostracized to some extent. So the idea is rather than give the same weight to all the hyperlinks, start with trusted pages, some trusted pages, okay? Trusted pages tend to point to each other more than they point to untrustworthy pages. So what you do essentially is you would start with a seed set of trusted pages. So that those are hand-picked seed set of trusted pages. Okay? Now you have the entire web graph in front of you. These, let's say you pick 1,000, those are the 1,000 nodes in the web graph. Okay? I give all of these 1, 1, 1 trust. Okay? And then I'll just let the trust propagation do its magic. I'm not even going to do distrust. All I'm going to do is trust. Okay? So the seed pages have trust 1, and whenever they wind up splitting, they're giving large number of pages their outlinks to, you know, avoid trustworthy people having way too many friends, in which case you can't trust their judgment. You start reducing just the splitting. When you split, you reduce the trust. When you propagate, you attenuate the thrust. Those are the two things you do. And then when two links come with, you know, for a node, there are two different links which both bring in thrust, you add them up. Very simple idea. Just one pass through the entire web graph. Feed forward pass. There's no cycle. So if you do this, then entire web graph now will have thrust numbers, which are, you know, numbers between 0 and 1. What you do is you have a big vector now. You normalize it into a probability. So you divide each entry by the sum of all these thrust values. It will become a probability vector. So now I have a probability vector. Where in PageRank can I throw in a probability vector? There's only one place, which is, what does a board user do? Normal PageRank algorithm says the board user goes to any page with uniform probability. And we found, hey, that's a good place. That's a good opportunity. If you want a board computer science user, it's not uniformly all pages. They are likely to go to ACM page with more probability than some other pages. We did this for topic-specific page rank. Trust rank is topic-specific page rank or user-specific page rank. Essentially, you are initializing that vector. You know what? The vector which basically says the probability that a board user goes to a particular page in the web graph, it's being initialized not with uniform probability distribution, but with the trust probability distribution. That's all they do. This is a VLDB 2004 paper. And the neat thing about this paper is they actually used the AltaVista crawl, which have, I think, 33 billion pages. You know, any of these ideas are nice enough to explain in a slide, but to actually show that it works and, you know, people should take you seriously, you need to make them work on a web-sized graph, or, you know, a fraction of the web-sized graph. So they work on the 2003 AltaVista crawl, and they show that, in fact, they are able to cut down spam much more than Google is, Google Page Rank is. Very simple idea, right? I mean, you know how to propagate trust. You know that there is this one place you can plug in any, you know, prior probability distribution vector, which was made to be equal to uniform probability distribution. Again, this actually brings up one more important point that I said last class, that I'm going to say this class. Random does not mean uniform distribution. Most people, not just you, most people think random means uniform distribution. Random does not mean that, does not have to mean uniform distribution. Random and clueless may be uniform. Okay, random and have some information about how the randomness is, you would know the distribution. Okay, so we'll end here. So that we have propagated trust to. Next class, Monty Python spam video and interactive reviews. Okay.